Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti, and I'm so glad that you guys are here. It is the most perfect storytelling weather here in the city. I'm here in New York. It is torrential downpouring, just it's dumping buckets outside, rain trickling down. I just got back from a brunch. Actually, it's Saturday, so I went to brunch earlier, my only outdoor activity of the day. And when I tell you, I came home and to my knees, like up from my ankles to my knees, I was wearing blue jeans, were soaked. So I was thrilled to get home, put on my comfy soft pajamas, sit on the couch, set up my microphone. I have a blanket on me. I have a peppermint tea on the table, and just relax and tell you guys a story. And I have to say, the story we're going to be telling today, it isn't something that's super uplifting. It's a little bit spooky. So we're going to dust it off and tell it today. But before I do that, just some housekeeping things, or just letting you guys know some things. So as this episode is going live, every Wednesday we post episodes, by the way, if you weren't already aware. This is episode number 4, which I am just so happy we're ticking along. I have all these episodes planned. I have such a great roadmap for where we're going and like all of these awesome topics that we're going to be covering, which I'm very excited about. That being said, if you guys ever have anything you want to suggest, feel free to either email me or send me a message on Instagram. I feel like Instagram might be the easiest way to just submit a quick suggestion. So our Instagram is Found Objects Podcast. Definitely follow the account as well, because every episode I'll be posting visuals to go along with it over on Instagram. So if you want to know what a particular person or place looked like, it'll all be on the Instagram. So check that out. Give us a follow. That being said, also follow the podcast on Spotify, podcast app, whatever you use, so you'll never miss an episode. And rate us 5 stars if you're feeling generous. But other than that, more personally, I will actually be across the pond when this episode goes live. So this episode will be posted on Wednesday, as all episodes are every Wednesday. But as this one is going live, I will be elsewhere. I will be traveling. I'll be in London visiting or meeting, technically, my boyfriend's family. He is British and I'm meeting I'm meeting his family for the first time. And my family is also coming along as well, my parents and my sister. So it's a family affair over in London. I am very excited for the trip because it's been a minute since I've been to London. I think the last time I went was before the pandemic. So it was like 2019, I think. And I love London. I love how old it is and just so many aspects of it. The food is great. And I'm most excited for this one Indian restaurant called Dishoom that I went to the last time that I visited. And I just haven't been able to get it out of my mind ever since. So I'm thrilled. We're actually going there, I think, the first night we get in. Yeah, we land. And then, you know, we're going to check into our Airbnb and whatnot. And then we go to Dishoom, which I'm thrilled about. So anyway, just a little personal update. That's where I will be. But of course, I will be posting as normal and it'll feel like I'm still here. And I think that is all for my housekeeping things, for my introduction of just random babbles. And now I'm ready to get into the episode. So let's do it. Try as we might, most people are vain. We care about the way that we look and the way that we present ourselves in the world. A huge part of our identity is often wrapped up in our beauty, our age, and any and all aspects of our outward appearance. And, you know, this is just stating facts here. Obviously, there's varying degrees of this, but, you know, you'd be lying if you said you didn't care about any aspect at all of your outward appearance. I mean, even if it's just like the jeans that you wear or the different or certain ways that you wear your hair, you know, there are aspects that each and every one of us cares about. And this is nothing new. For centuries, people have gone to hell and back in the name of beauty and immortality. And more often than not, what was thought to be the cure-all turns out to do more harm than good. If you ever heard the saying that if it seems too good to be true, it likely is, well, that is the story of radium. Today on Found Objects, we will dive into the rise in popularity of radium and its ultimate downfall by unpacking the tragic story of the Radium Girls, among other deadly attempts at attaining beauty through radium. When you imagine someone trying to mask their age by making modifications to their appearance, what do you think of? Because personally, I would think of maybe the things that I personally do. Botox, I have experimented with Botox, you know, dyeing my hair. When I get gray hairs, I've been going gray since I was 21. So things like that. This desire to stay young, healthy, vibrant, none of it is groundbreaking. Of course, people have wanted to prolong their life and improve their quality of life however they can. And they've been doing this for years, forever, I should say. Historically, people have become obsessed with seeking this magical elixir of life, whatever it may be. And so many people have actually devoted their lives to it. Alexander the Great, for example, was said to have come across a healing river of paradise in the 4th century BC that was said to preserve youth. During the Middle Ages, some Europeans believed in the mythical king Prester John, whose kingdom allegedly contained a fountain of youth and a river of gold. Spanish sources asserted that the Taino Indians of the Caribbean spoke of a magic fountain and rejuvenating river that existed somewhere north of Cuba. But let's consider Juan Ponce de Leon, a Spanish conquistador. You might recall his name from history class in middle school or something like that. And sure, Juan became one of the first Europeans to land on mainland America in Florida in April of 1513, but he is more famously known for his own quest for the Fountain of Youth, a fabled stream that would extend the life of anyone lucky enough to drink from it. But despite the legend, I'm sure we've all heard this, you know, the Fountain of Youth and whatnot, there's no historical evidence to prove that this covert mission happened while in Florida. According to J. Michael Francis, a history professor at the University of South Florida, quote, he was not at all interested in finding some miraculous spring, lake, or body of water, from what I can gather. In fact, Juan's salvaged letters only spoke of his desire to settle the land, spread Christianity, and discover whether Florida was an island or a peninsula. But we all know that the rumor mill answers to no one. So, for some reason, historians began linking Ponce de Leon with the Fountain of Youth shortly after his death. Some say he sought the Fountain of Youth in order to cure his sexual impotence, which in fact is untrue because he fathered several children, and some accounts delighted in Ponce de Leon being distracted from the real issues of colonization by occupying himself with the quest. But the most important account came from Antonio de Herrera y Torcillas, the Spanish king's chief historian of the Indies. In 1601, Antonio wrote that Ponce de Leon found a fountain that turned, quote, old men to boys on his first voyage to Florida. So this really solidified his reputation as a legend seeker, truth or not. When the Spanish ceded Florida to the U.S. in 1819, writers and artists clung to the legend of Ponce de Leon and his Fountain of Youth. In the centuries since then, numerous places now claim to be the Fountain of Youth because, of course, like that's just, you know, naturally a tourist draw, right? Or just people that are gullible enough to believe in it. St. Augustine, Florida claims to have the original Fountain of Youth, and I've actually been to St. Augustine. I went for a wedding back in December, and I loved it. Like, I thought it was so historic, so, like, rich with history. Very, very interesting place. But they claim to have the original Fountain of Youth, and it's the site of the oldest successful European settlement in America. Donellan, Florida claims to have a Fountain of Youth in the water of Rainbow Springs. Silver Springs State Park near Ocala claims to have the same healing properties. And these are all a big part of the legacy of Florida. You know, a lot of people, when they think of Florida, they think of the Fountain of Youth legend and whatnot. But one stands out from the tourist noise, and that's because its water really is different. In the town of Punta Gorda, there is a green-tiled fountain inconspicuously situated on the edge of a parking lot near the harbor. It pulls water from an artesian well below ground. And in a nod to Ponce de Leon himself, there are old ships emblazoned on each side of it. The water is heavy in sulfates, giving it that distinct rotten egg smell that you get when you smell something that has sulfates. But more importantly, it is teeming with radium. When it was evaluated, the Punta Gordian well water clocked in at 9.2 picocuries of radium per liter when it was tested in 1983, and this exceeded the recommended radium limit set at 5 picocuries per liter. So think about it, like the recommended limit is 5. This came in at 9.2. So it was packed to the brim with radium. So there's a public health notice on one side of the fountain that warns this water exceeds the maximum contaminant level for radioactivity. But locals do not heed that warning. Punta Gordians have proudly reaped the benefits of this so-called rejuvenative fountain as far back as 1894. They swear by the, quote, healing properties of radium in their water. And this is probably due to the lasting marketing schemes that were deemed factual back when radium became popularized in the early 1900s. In the early days, post-discovery, small doses of radium were thought to be super healthy. In fact, it was marketed as a cure-all for a slew of ailments. The radium craze, this obsession with radium, truly started in 1904 when L.D. Garner began marketing a radium-infused health water that he called Liquid Sunshine. Liquid Sunshine promised benefits similar to that of the Fountain of Youth, so making you beautiful and look young forever, and the people of Punta Gorda got it for free in their fountain. However, belief in radium's health benefits, like I said, people thought that it was this cure-all for all ailments, all problems, and it would make you look young forever and beautiful forever and whatnot. Like, obviously that sounds too good to be true, because it was. You know, the belief that these things, or this element was going to be helpful, was rooted in a massive misstep in logic. Early experiments using radium to kill cancer cells had been a success. If it could kill cancer, the assumption was that it could kill whatever else was ailing you. People just didn't draw the logical conclusion that killing bad cells could ultimately kill you as well. You know, if it's going to kill the bad cells, it could kill the good cells too. Instead, doctors started experimenting with it as a cure-all for things like tuberculosis and lupus. And while it did seem to cure, quote, cure these diseases, the lasting long-term effects of radium ingestion or radiation were not studied. Conveniently, not studied. Everyone was just focused on how it was a quick fix. The lingering side effects, death, were a problem for another day. And honestly, those side effects were not even top of mind because they took months or even years to materialize in a healthy person. But people were hooked. They drank radium water, brushed their teeth with radium toothpaste, kind of like the charcoal trend. I feel like charcoal really had its moment, but this was radium back then. They were using radium toothpaste and radium cosmetics. Why would they think or have any reason to think that science would lie? You know, it's like suddenly saying that probiotics and everything that we ingest nowadays is actually toxic. You know, it's a hard mindset to shift from once you hear it, like, oh, this is like the cure-all, this is the thing, this is the trend. You know, why would people lie about that, right? Its demand was so high that in 1915, a single gram of radium cost what would be about $1.9 million in today's money. The irony of the story for the people of Punta Gorda, Florida, where I just said they had that green-tiled, they still do, fountain that is connected to an artesian well and whatnot, so they swear by the water that is in this Fountain of Youth, quote, Fountain of Youth, due to its trace amounts of radium, they think. But the rejuvenative properties that they likely experience are actually coming from the presence of a different element, magnesium. Because what we had to come to find out the hard way is that radium is in fact extremely dangerous. Magnesium? Obviously not. Radium? Extremely dangerous. Enter the story of the Radium Girls. They were the sole reason that people realized that the magic elixir of life was actually poison. Aside from being incorporated into beauty routines and treatments for illness, radium was also used commercially in luminescent paint to illuminate numbers on watches and military dials, especially at the onset of World War I in 1917. One of these commercial paints was called Undark, and it was a mixture of radium-226 and zinc sulfide, the latter of which would luminesce, when struck by the alpha radiation particles emitted from radium. So luminesce meaning like it would like appear bright and shiny. More on this later, we will get to that. Women, due to their small hands and dexterity, were hired as dial workers to painstakingly paint the numbers onto these watch dials, gauges, clocks, etc., at the U.S. Radium Corporation in Orange, New Jersey. Since they were used widely in the war, women were happy to know that their work was being viewed as a patriotic contribution to the war effort. It was tedious work, but it paid well, especially for a woman's salary of the time, and the more they painted, the more they earned. It was reported that the women would make 1.5, 1.5 cents a watch on average, which sounds like not a lot today, but it was actually a very fair wage back then. Some earned more than 3 times the average factory floor worker salary, and some even earned more than their fathers. They were ranked in the top 5% of female wage earners, and on average took home $20, which is about $370 today, a week. Though the fastest painters could easily earn more, sometimes as much as double, giving the top earners a salary annually of $2,080, which is almost 40 grand today. It turned out to be so lucrative that women who got one of these coveted painting jobs then recruited their friends and sisters, which makes total sense. Of course, if you have a great gig, if you love it, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to talk about it to your friends and your family and say, oh, you should come too. You should get in on this action, you know, like, love it here. Get to hang out with my friends all day, my family. So, you know, win-win. These dial painters took pride in their work. And when they noticed the transfer of luminescence from the paint onto their clothes and their hair, they actually loved it. They relished in it. Because the glow that clung to these women because of this paint, it was this inexplicable glow, made these women stand out like a sore thumb and garnered them the nickname Ghost Girls. They had no reason to be concerned, right? You know, radium was this cure-all. It was this fountain of youth ingredient. It was this magical, you know, glowing ingredient that, you know, at the time was not seen to be a threat, was not seen to be something bad. So they intentionally wore their best dresses on the job just so they could get their clothes lumified, like get traces of radium on their clothing, you know, in their hair. And some of them applied the paint directly to their teeth because it would give them radiant smiles. It was like a teeth whitener of that time. And you may be appalled to learn that they put this paint in their mouths, but it didn't faze them because when onboarding, managers at the U.S. Radium Corporation taught them that the best way to gain precision was to use a method called pointing. And this, I'm going to explain this. So since the watches and the dials were extremely small, they were instructed to wet the brush in their mouth and use their lips to bring the paintbrush to a fine point. So to make it more sharp so they could easily get in there on the dials and be precise with their whatever they were doing. So this being said, the fact that they were literally encouraged by their employers to put the paintbrushes in their mouths with traces of radium on it in their mouths, naturally, there were going to be some questions. So during onboarding, during training and orientations and whatnot, some women asked, they're like, how safe is this stuff? And they were assured by the managers that they had nothing to worry about, even when the chemists and scientists on site were provided protective equipment when handling radium. I'm going to say that one more time because that is bonkers. So the women were like, yeah. Like they were told, no worries, put the paintbrushes in your mouth. They were told, oh, it's totally fine. Paint your teeth with it. You know, put it on your clothes and in your hair. Meanwhile, you know, they were telling the lowly paid workers, you know, the factory workers this, but then the chemists and the scientists, when they came on site, they were provided protective equipment when handling radium. It was kind of known at the time that there might be something fishy about this stuff, you know, but they didn't seem to care when it came to these women and their lives, you know. So it was known at this time, supposedly, that radium in large quantities was dangerous. But for some reason, they're like, a little bit won't kill them. And the women believed them. They trusted that the little vials of radium to mix with their paint and glue was completely safe, until things started to get ugly. The dial workers started suffering from odd and mysterious ailments that no one could seem to diagnose. They started to experience toothaches, weakening jaw, spontaneous bone fractures, anemia, and full body aches. One of the first known victims was Amelia Maggia. She went by Molly for short, and she was the daughter of Italian immigrants with a determination to make her way in the world just as her parents had. So when the U.S. Radium Corporation plant opened and were seeking dial painters, she jumped on the opportunity. In 1917, at the age of 20, Molly became a working woman. The work was relatively easy for the pay, and she was treated well. So what did she do? She recruited all of her sisters. They worked hard too, often working 7 days a week. By 1921, so she started in 1917, so 4 years later. By 1921, so 4 years after she started working at this factory, Molly's dedication to her work had some unintended consequences. At the age of 24, literally 24, guys, I need to emphasize that because this is just crazy. So she was 24 years old and she started to suffer from debilitating toothaches. Her dentist removed the problem tooth, like the one that was bothering her, but then when she returned with even more pain, he noticed that other teeth had fallen out and the empty sockets were not healing, which sounds so painful. Also, she's 24 and seemingly in perfect health. So what is going on? What's worse is she was experiencing necrosis of the jaw, which is when your jaw bone literally disintegrates. And the necrosis spread to the roof of her mouth and the bones of her ears, and she quickly became anemic. And the condition was worsening by the day. She ended up passing away on September the 12th, 1922, at the age of 25. And I have full body chills over this. I'd actually heard of this Molly's story before, and every time I hear it, it's just so heartbreaking because she, you know, she wanted this life of, she wanted to make something of herself and wanted to, you know, get out there and do something, and then also recruited all of her siblings to do it as well, which is just so heartbreaking. Many women suffered the same fate as Molly. By 1924, as workers continued to pass away in mysterious circumstances, managers at the U.S. Radium Corporation hired a team of scientists from Harvard to investigate the untimely deaths of these women. Because they probably had to. I feel like there was probably a lot of unrest, and they were like, fuck, we gotta do something about this, get to the bottom of it. The Harvard scientists discovered that the plant was thick with radium dust, naturally. I mean, that makes sense because there's radium in the paint, right? So that's where it came from. The investigation concluded that the deaths were connected to the factory work. Still, the scientists noted that radium in small quantities had such a safe reputation historically that they were reluctant to blame it on that completely. Even this cautious assessment did not go over well with the factory management. The U.S. Radium Corporation refused to allow the study to be published, saying the information was too sensitive to be released. The U.S. Radium Corporation, like I said, refused to allow the study to be published, saying it was too sensitive, and they did not tell their workers about the findings. They did not tell the public. They were the ultimate gaslighting machine, even as women were dropping like flies on their warehouse floors. You know, like they had this responsibility to do something, and yet they did not. They did not. Instead of telling the truth, they publicly cited syphilis as the cause of widespread illness, which is devastating because that has to do with, again, this is a time period when that would devastate a person's reputation. You know, this is back in the 1920s, and to say that a woman like Molly, who had passed away, you know, had all these issues of with her mouth and her jaw and her ears and her, like, and to say, oh yeah, she just had syphilis, you know, which was this like dirty disease quote. So the news of dying dial workers started to spread despite the best efforts of the U.S. Radium factory. another team of doctors from the Consumers League of New Jersey, who were building a reputation for worker safety advocacy, started their own investigation. They were appalled by the results. They published their findings, which probably pissed a lot of people off at the factory, which declared that a terrible, unidentifiable occupational disease was running rampant at the Orange, New Jersey factory. Based on these alarm bells sounding, pathologist and Essex County medical examiner Harrison Martland did another investigation in 1925. He developed a test that proved conclusively that radium had poisoned the watch painters by destroying their bodies from the inside, which sounds terrible. His test found that the workers were exhaling radon gas. So because they'd been exposed to so much radium, like, they would breathe out and their exhale would contain radon gas, which sounds, I don't know exactly to the extent of how terrible that might be because I'm not a scientist, but it sounds terrible. It sounds unnatural, obviously. So remember when I said earlier some super sciencey words to describe radium's luminescent properties? Well, let's dive right back into that for a second because it's important to understand how radium works in order to understand what happened to these women. So bear with me. Radium, the element, exists in a state of perpetual breakdown. As it decays, subatomic particles fizz away in all directions, making it imbalanced and even more prone to further decay. It's in a constant cycle of transformation due to breakdown, which makes it radioactive. It primarily discards alpha particles in a process called alpha radiation. And in the grand scheme of radiation, alpha radiation isn't all that bad in most cases, but Martland discovered that when radium was ingested, like, you know, because these women are putting it in their mouths, the alpha radiation literally became poison. Radon gas was produced as radium decayed inside the human body, so like as they were exhaling, it was coming out as gas, radon gas. So measuring the radon gas in the dial workers' exhalations was key to figuring out that radium was the poison, was the quiet killer. The radium dust, noted by the Harvard team, posed a definite hazard because it could be inhaled. But the reason that the hardworking dial painters were so much sicker than others in the dusty factory, you know, the people that were just there maybe cleaning up and whatnot, the reason why the dial painters themselves were obviously so affected was because they were putting the brushes in their mouths and brushing their teeth with it and all of these various things. So they were literally ingesting it. Every time a painter put a brush in her mouth to bring the bristles to a sharper point to do her job better, she ended up swallowing radium. And obviously this evidence was damning. The radium industry tried, as they might, to deny the findings and discredit Martland until they were blue in the face. Like, this was, you know, a life or death situation for them in terms of keeping the factory open, which, you know, of course, completely, you know, ignores the fact that it was literally, like, the fact that the factory was open was killing people. So think about it. But of course, like, you know, they're going to think about the factory first. Gaslighting alert number two in this story, but the ailing dial workers who became known as the Radium Girls decided to fight back. They decided to sue the U.S. Radium Corporation themselves. Many attorneys did not want to touch this case with a 10-foot pole because the radium industry had deep pockets and workplace safety standards weren't as prevalent at a federal level at this time. The five women who were the primary plaintiffs in the case were living on borrowed time. You know, they were going to pass away at any minute, unfortunately, because they were so ill. But in 1927, attorney Raymond Barry agreed to take on their case. Even with an attorney on their side, though, they ran into issue after issue. An article from May 10th, 1928 states, five women who are trying to sue U.S. Radium Corporation for damages from their deathbed cannot obtain a hearing in court even after 13 other women from the plant have already died. So five women are sick, 13 women have already passed away, and for some reason, they can't get a hearing in court, which is just, you know, it's absurd. Absurd. That is why it's important to talk about this, because we have come such a long way, and yet it's just so sad that women had to suffer because their employer just did not care about them. Okay, continuing. So it was clear that the media was just as outraged by the injustice as the dial painters. The case was delayed multiple times due to a statute of limitation concern, multiple of them, and unnecessary court recesses that lasted months. So they were kind of stonewalling them in a way, kind of just pushing it until, I can assume, I mean, I don't think there's documentation of this, but it seems like the factory and whoever, you know, is on the side of the factory is like, maybe if we stall this long enough, these five sick ladies will just die, you know, and then we won't have to deal with them. Anyway, the media backlash continued, but it wasn't enough to get the case to trial. So the media was actually on the Radium Girls side, which, you know, you hardly ever see the media doing the right thing, I feel like, in a lot of these historic cases or stories that I'm telling, so it's interesting. But on June 4th, 1928, the Female Dial Painters of Orange, New Jersey, actually accepted an out-of-court settlement with the U.S. Radium Corporation, and they actually got pretty lucky with this. I mean, I still would have liked to see them go to trial and show the evidence and get this factory just closed down and for good. But they actually did get lucky with this because Radium Dial, their counterparts in Ottawa, Illinois, did not fare so well. Radium Dial opened its doors in 1922. And if you're following the timeline of our story, this was actually the same year that Amelia Maggia died. So the radium industry persisted despite all growing allegations that radium, even in small quantities, was lethal, which is just so upsetting. Like, word had definitely spread at this point that there could be something going on here. Like, this woman had passed away, her jaw deteriorated, like, you know, she literally died from the inside out from being poisoned, and yet this other factory opened its doors the very same year, which is just, okay, something's going on here, something fishy. An ad for employment for Radium Dial said this, quote, "Radium Dial requires the services of several girls for studio work. Ideal location and surroundings, unusually clean and attractive work. Good pay while learning." So that was an ad that was put out trying to recruit girls to sign up. The part that really sticks out to me is unusually clean and attractive work, which is just so ridiculous, like unusually clean and attractive work, except for you're going to be poisoned from the inside out and die. Like, I don't see that advertised. Now, I don't think we expected them to acknowledge the suspected dangers associated with radium, especially since Martland didn't come to realize the truth fully until 3 years after this. But come on, the dial painters in Ottawa had definitely read news coverage. They definitely heard murmurs about the New Jersey workers, but the Radium Dial claimed that it was the element mesothorium that was the culprit in New Jersey. So they were saying, like, oh, radium is not the issue. Like, this other thing, like, that was what happened in New Jersey. We don't have that. You know, our paint at Radium Dial is safe because it doesn't contain any of that stuff. It only has radium, which, you know, radium, as we know, is the fountain of youth, and it makes you glow. Like, how could that be terrible? It kills cancer cells. How could that be terrible? Well, we'll come to find out. They gaslit the hell out of these young, bright women with this concept, with this thought. Lo and behold, women started getting sick just as they did in New Jersey here in Ottawa, because, surprise, radium was the problem, not mesothorium. I wish we had all seen that one coming, because it would have saved so many lives. One of the most renowned characters, renowned, I always struggle with that one too. There's some certain words you'll find through listening to all my episodes that I always struggle with. One of the most renowned characters in the Ottawa story, her name is Catherine Wolfe Donahue, and she started working at Radium Dial when it opened in 1922. In accounts of her time as a dial painter, she recalled using the common pointing technique, using her mouth to make the paintbrush sharper, causing her to ingest radium daily. She recalled being careless with radium powder, even noting that washing off after shift wasn't mandatory. She recalled her clothes in her closet hanging with a phosphorant hue. So when she, unsurprisingly, fell ill, she became the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit against Radium Dial in 1935. So if you think about it, she started working there in 1922. So this is 1935 that she's filing this lawsuit. Like, I wonder what state she was in at this time, you know? Similarly to the case in Orange, New Jersey, the statute of limitations stalled the case. But this time around, there was no settlement. Another 2 years passed before the Ottawa women, led by Catherine, had their hearing on July 23rd, 1937, with the Illinois Industrial Commission. Catherine's raw honesty and the severity of her condition made her the poster child for the case. She had some crazy testimony stories as well. She even presented a box in court containing, like, a literal box. She opened the box and it contained pieces of her own jawbone. And she, you know, she understood how to get the shock value and just to get people to wake up and see what is actually happening because of this radioactive element that they are ingesting. Like, her jaw literally fell apart in pieces and she could show it to a courtroom, which is just insane. Catherine famously collapsed in court due to her illness, which is very sad, and then continued to attend in later days from a mobile bed. So this woman, she was fearless. Like, she literally passed out because she was so weak because of her condition, because of this factory and its cruelty in letting these women ingest radium. She collapses, but then comes back to court on a mobile bed because she's like, I will see this through. She weighed a shocking 71 pounds at the time and was so pale and gaunt that she was inducted into the, quote, Society of the Living Dead. She was impressively determined to make a change in labor practices, and her dedication to the case, even from her deathbed, was life-changing for so many women to come. So props to Catherine. We love her. In 1938, the five Ottawa Dial painters won their case. All of them won damages. Very exciting day for them. But unfortunately, Catherine would not live to see that day. However, this case established a baseline for companies to be held responsible for the health and safety of its employees, and it led to a variety of reforms as well as the creation of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is OSHA. You might have seen that before. But it turns out, of course, a harrowing, harrowing truth, dying women and guilty verdicts for some reason couldn't stop the radium paint industry. In 1934, the president of Radium Dial, Joseph Kelly, was ousted by his board, and as a result, the business shuttered in the following years due to the outcomes of the trial. So we think, oh, maybe that's that. But unfortunately, this isn't the last radium paint company he opened. This terrible man, Joseph Kelly, he moved his shop down the road and renamed it to Luminous Processes. So he just rebranded this poison. I can't get over this. As a big FU to those who put Radium Dial out of business, he hired women who were put out of work when Radium Dial closed. So he continued to put women in danger, even after the damning evidence presented by Catherine Donahue, her literal jawbone fragments, and so many other victims of radium radiation. The Dial workers were willing to risk continuing because the paycheck was too good to pass up, especially because, you know, they were in the throes of the Great Depression. So people needed the work, they needed the money, they would risk it, which is just so upsetting to hear. In 1976, Luminous Processes was fined by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They found that workers were exposed to radiation 1,666 times higher than the regulations allowed. That's 42 years. Guys, doing the math here, he reopened in 1934, his new factory. They didn't catch him until 1976. So that's 42 years of stealthy operation, 42 years of putting people at risk at work despite federal regulations, 42 years of allowing radiation to infiltrate not only the workers' bodies, but also the unsuspecting town of Ottawa. It affected the entire town. And Ottawa, to this day, is still radioactive due to the excessive use of radium by Kelly's companies for decades. And to make matters worse, after the factories closed, the warehouses were then used for, this gives me chills, for storing meat, and then turned into farmers' markets. Edible things. People were ingesting, were eating these things unsuspecting, like not knowing that they were radioactive. The people of Ottawa were purchasing food from a radioactive site for years without knowing it. The radium girls, so the women involved in the factories, and the unlucky people in Ottawa weren't the only ones who suffered. Take Marie Curie. I actually did a whole podcast episode on her in my last podcast, Thick and Thin. Marie Curie, she was actually the female scientist who discovered radium in 1898. And she also died because of the exposure to radiation that she experienced as she was developing or discovering and developing the element. And guess what her cause of death was? To put it simply, anemia. Might sound familiar. Maybe Molly's name rings a bell. Molly, the first woman we discussed that passed away due to the exposure at the factory. Anemia is caused by long-term exposure to radiation, and our little science lesson taught us that radium emits alpha radiation. Despite her intellect, Marie Curie was wary to acknowledge the extent of the harmful side effects of her discovery. She tended to defend the element as if it were a child under attack, according to experts. Her discovery did lead to her Nobel Prize win, so with such a huge contribution to the world of science, and being a woman doing that, I understand that part, you know, she felt invincible. But she made a few fatal mistakes. She was known to keep vials of radioactive isotopes in her skirt pockets as she worked. She was known to get radiation burns for mishandling radioactive substances. She was known to admire the luminescence of radium in the dark. She had a huge sense of pride, but she should have known better than to not take proper precautions. And it cost Marie her life. When she toured the U.S. in 1921, hoping to raise enough money to further her radium research, American dignitaries presented her with a gram of radium. I mean, remember, it was super expensive, so this is a pretty huge gift. But it was carefully contained in a hefty lead box. Even the American dignitaries that she was meeting with at the time knew of its potential dangers. And it seems like Pierre Curie, Marie's husband and partner in pioneering radioactivity, knew of the dangers as well, especially early on, because in an interview in 1903, Pierre described the hazards of radium, saying, quote, he would not care to trust himself in a room with a kilo of pure radium, as it would doubtless destroy his eyesight and burn all of his skin off of his body and probably kill him. So this was in 1903 that Marie Curie, the founder, the inventor, rather, of radium, her husband, Pierre, they knew damn well the dangers of radium. And yet, there was no alarm bells raised in 1903 that would, you know, deter the exponential growth of the radium industry and the opening of all of these factories where women would put these paintbrushes in their mouths. Following Marie's death in 1934, her lab notebooks were said to be too highly contaminated to be safely handled and had to be stored in lead boxes. Like, not even physically her body, just the things that she was using while she was studying, her notebooks. Suspicious. I guess they just didn't realize that a little goes a long way. Interestingly, after their deaths, Marie Curie and many of the other radium girls were also buried in lead-lined coffins. So they were lined with lead to prevent the radioactive material from seeping into the earth. And it's a good thing, actually, that someone had their wits about them to do this. Like, you know, try as they might, people just in general, defending radium, someone was smart enough to insist that, you know, these women that were exposed to radium, their bodies were encased in lead-lined coffins, like I just said. Like, someone did this. And thank God they did, because our friend, through the story today, Molly Maggia, was exhumed in 1927 to be tested for radioactivity as evidence for the trial. And lo and behold, her body was still so radioactive, Molly Maggia's body glowed years after her death, which is just obviously so unnatural. So you tell me, how much are you willing to sacrifice in the name of youth and beauty? Because, you know, like I said earlier, I started out our tale today with talking about the Fountain of Youth, that green tiled fountain that contains radium. And even today, people are like, we don't care, radium, you know, it makes us glow. It makes you feel, appear youthful, and it kills bad cancer cells. And, like, you know, people just selectively forget because they love the folklore of it. The folklore of, oh, this is the Fountain of Youth and whatnot. Like, you know, I'm going to put my hands in it. Just because they think it has this quality of giving you that beauty and youthfulness for life. So that, plus the radium that people were using, you know, painting on clock dials. Like I said, the women at the time, before they knew how dangerous it was, they loved working at the factory alongside their friends and family and, you know, would selectively, like on purpose, put radium in their mouths, on their teeth to make them glow, in their hair, and on their clothes, because they wanted to literally glow. But now that we know what we know, you know, it's been debunked. How much are you willing to sacrifice for a hefty paycheck that will keep food on the table for your families, your health, your quality of life? And that was the impossible dilemma for the Radium Girls at their time. But I'm so happy that they finally saw their days in court, and you know, it was then common knowledge, but it's unfortunate that it took so many lives before that was the case. So I wanted to tell the Radium Girls story today, if you haven't heard of it before. Just madness. And it is just so crazy to me to think that Marie Curie and a bunch of these ladies that were exposed to radium, their bodies still glow today. This town, Ottawa, in Illinois, is still radioactive. Like, these things don't just go away. So we have to be so careful with things like this. So, little science lesson for you guys today. Interesting story. We will remember these women. I hope that next week I'll come back with a lighter story, something a little bit less depressing. But as we know, a lot of history can be kind of upsetting, but good to know regardless, because it's the only way that we don't repeat the bad things, right? By knowing what those things even are. So anyway, thank you all for listening. And remember, things are not always as they appear. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.